Okay, so today on the Loopcast, I have Leslie Ann Warner, and we are talking about AFRICOM. So as everybody knows, sort of AFRICOM has come into the news, and a lot more attention has been sort of turned to Africa because of, you know, issues in Somalia, issues in Mali, Benghazi. And so I was interested in sort of doing a conversation on, you know, not just U.S. interests, but how is the military, you know, dealing with AFRICOM? AFRICOM is a relatively new command, and so, you know, Leslie knows a lot about AFRICOM, so we're going to sort of pick her brain about this. So my first question is, you know, give us a general history of AFRICOM as a command, because I think, you know, for most of the listeners of the Loopcast, you know, we're sort of aware that, you know, AFRICOM has been a sort of issue for U.S. policy. You know, we had the most famously the Black Hawk Down incident in the early 90s, you know, the bombings of, you know, the embassies in Kenya, Tanzania, you know, Bush's involvement in Somalia, and now, you know, sort of Obama. So, you know, Mali, Benghazi, you know, all these issues. So give us a history, like, you know, what has led to the creation of AFRICOM? Why does it exist? And sort of, you know, what are the sort of the historical points we should be paying attention to?
First of all, thank you, Sina, for having me on this program.
It's no problem.
And sure, I'll give you a brief history of AFRICOM. First of all, Africa used to be covered under the old Unified Campaign Plan. Africa was covered by three different combatant commands. And most of the continent was covered by European Command, and then the Horn was covered by Central Command, and the Pacific Islands were covered by Pacific Command. And what that meant is that instead of having a unified command whose priority and sole purpose was to focus on security issues and security threats to the U.S. in Africa, you had three different combatant commands who were each focused on different areas of the world. And in the mid-2000s, a decision was made by the president and within DOD to establish a unified command for Africa. And this was, I believe, based on the growing strategic importance of Africa to the United States. And you could say it was for reasons of political capital, strategic resources, counterterrorism, and emerging markets, things of that nature, but also in terms of the way that the U.S. was starting to understand security in the post-9/11 world. If you look at our strategic guidance, you see that we view security in a very globalized sense, and Africa is part of the world, and, you know, and so it made sense that not only are there challenges in Africa that we need to facilitate, but there are also security threats that emanate from Africa that we need to be prepared to address, and we need to be prepared to help our partner nations address those threats, and if that is not possible, address them ourselves, as we're seeing now.
Sure. What would you consider to be key events that, and, you know, in AFRICOM's history, both its, you know, creation and sort of its existence? You know, just if you could pick three, you know, key events, or one or two, you know, what would you consider really, you know, that led to the creation and sort of in its early history?
I think it's difficult for me to pick three events just because I wasn't there, but I would refer listeners to a paper that was written by the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for African Affairs at the time, Teresa Whalen. It's called Why AFRICOM? And it talks about the history of the U.S. military in Africa and the Unified Campaign Plan and the decisions that were made leading up to the creation of AFRICOM. And I think that it's a true insider's perspective because she was actually involved in the negotiations within the government to create AFRICOM, as well as the socialization of AFRICOM to other stakeholders within the government and stakeholders in Africa. But just as a point of reference, AFRICOM was set up as a sub-unified command to European Command in 2007 and then set up in 2008. And just as a last point, when I was listening as a newer Africa analyst to the justification for AFRICOM, one of the things that people would reference is the fact that the U.S. had to keep going in and out of Africa in the 90s. to do non-combatant evacuation operations, or NEOs, and that it just took so much effort to keep deploying from the U.S. to Africa, and it just made it easier to be able to do that, or the planning for those sorts of operations from a centralized, unified command. So that could have contributed to it as well.
So now that we've sort of done a general history, let's go back to the history and sort of look at it from the perspective of the three sort of leaders of, you know, people who have been assigned to as the head of AFRICOM, sort of General Ward, General Hamm, and now the newest sort of General Rodriguez, General. So how would you describe each of their commanding styles, especially with, you know, you made this great point to me earlier about sort of Ward was more about sort of capacity building and sort of partnerships, whereas Hamm is sort of, you know, CT and sort of, you know, if I could use, the adjective, a little more muscular, a little more aggressive. And, you know, Rodriguez is newly appointed, so, you know, what will be his style, or what can we say, you know, will he continue sort of more of sort of Hamm's, you know, leadership, or more, you know, Ward, or will it be a sort of combination of the two?
That's an excellent question. From what I've been told, from people who have experienced experience with the commanders of Africa Command, I believe that General Ward had been working on Africa before when he was at European Command, and what people say about him and what's reflected in his public statements is that he had a personal commitment to the building partner capacity mission that AFRICOM was supposed to have, as I call it jokingly, the touchy-feely conflict prevention interagency new combatant command that AFRICOM was supposed to be when it was first proposed several years ago. And that was, you could argue that that is based on reality of the, there was a demand signal for that sort of combatant command based on what we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan, that you need a non-DOD-centric combatant command, but also because it was arguably easier to sell it to African partners, that it was not going to be a warfighting machine. However, March of 2011 happens, and you have the change of command between Ward and Hamm. Obviously, Hamm was not to blame for the intervention in Libya, but that was his second day or second week on the job. It happened very quickly after he got there. And on one hand, you could argue that that may have shaped his approach to the security problems, that his approach to security in the AFRICOM AOR. On the other hand, it's also been argued to me that the fact that he didn't have that personal commitment, like the history that Ward had in building the touchy-feely aspect of the command, may have influenced the way that he approached things. Another argument that has been made to me is that, that within the U.S., within AFRICOM, there was a need to reestablish a constituency within the U.S. for AFRICOM, and so that it's possible that with increasing buy-in from our African government and military partners, there was less of a need to pitch the touchy-feely building partner capacity conflict prevention aspect of AFRICOM, and that by 2011-2012, it was more important to emphasize the more tangible, more kinetic counterterrorism capabilities that AFRICOM could bring to bear for a beltway-focused constituency that was focused on now on defense cuts.
So then what can we infer then about, you know, Rodriguez, I think it was a month ago he came?
Had his Senate confirmation hearing about 2 weeks ago. Okay. I don't know that he's been confirmed as yet, but the change of command is supposed to happen based on rumint. It's supposed to happen in about in a few weeks.
So when he, you know, what can we infer from, you know, is there anything we can infer about, you know, his leadership? I mean, it seems, you know, if we were to say that, you know, Ward was really about building capacity, Hamm is more about, you know, beltway constituency and sort of doing more kinetic ops. I mean, you know, which impulse will win, or do you think Rodriguez will sort of be able to balance the two? Like the, you know, the less sexy, you know, building capacity, and the more, you know, muscular, aggressive sort of CT and sort of more kinetic operations? Or do you think it's just he's going to just walk up right up the middle and be able to balance the two?
That would be ideal, just because he would have to balance these two constituencies of people who would like it to go back to the touchy-feely building partner capacity, or people who would like a tangible benefit of having kinetic CT ops. I think that, at least from what I've read about General Rodriguez, he has experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, which may contribute to a more kinetic approach. And also keep in mind that we're going through an aggressive phase, a more aggressive phase, arguably, of budget cuts. So there could be an increased justification for doing CT ops. And another thing to keep in mind is that unlike the last change of command, there is now an active war going on in the Sahel that wasn't as intense. It wasn't there in the past. And so now there is a huge demand signal for more kinetic operations. So that may influence him. And however, and I'll probably get to this later, now, in light of what has happened in North Africa and the Sahel, now is an excellent time to pause and think about what AFRICOM has been doing in the future and how he, as the new combatant commander, can move forward and change that. And improve the way that the COCOM has been doing operations, but I'm sure we'll get to that later.
Sure. So let's switch gears from, historical and leadership issues to what is AFRICOM's mission? Sort of, in the first part of the interview, you described this as rather broad. I mean, it seems like you could easily tease out, counter-narcotics, counter-terror, foreign internal defense mission, and even sort of, development and humanitarian assistance. So what do we consider, what does AFRICOM consider its mission to be? And then, what's its mission in principle? And then what can we consider its mission in, reality and practice?
So AFRICOM's mission, broadly defined, it's to protect the United States from threats emanating from Africa, and obviously from a U.S. perspective, that's the most important. However, it is also to build African partner military capacity to address global security threats, or threats that could emanate from Africa and affect the U.S. So we want them to take care of threats in their neighborhood so that we don't have to send our military in and do that. That's the gist of their mission. And under that mission, it includes activities such as you mentioned, counterterrorism, counter-narcotics, maritime security, security sector reform, or a more institutionally focused program such as defense sector reform that they're doing in Liberia, South Sudan, and the DRC.
Okay. So, from this sort of mission, this general, statement of mission, what can we sort of say, about AFRICOM, how it's sort of, what are the funding streams, who's responsible for staffing, and not specific staffing, but sort of, from what services it's, pulling its people and, pulling brigades from. And then, lastly, how is it structured? Are we talking about, is it a flexible structure? Is the structure, allows them to, sort of accomplish and go after all these missions? Or would you say that it's more, really designed for one purpose? Sort of highlight, give us a, basic, explanation.
Sure. I'll start talking a bit about the structure. I should have mentioned earlier that AFRICOM has service components that are underneath it, and those are Marine Forces Africa, or MARFORAF, Naval Forces Africa, NAVAF, Air Forces Africa, which may be FF, and then Army Africa. And those are based, MARFORAF is in Stuttgart, they're in Stuttgart, along with AFRICOM. NAVAF is in Naples. RF is somewhere in Italy. I can't remember at this particular moment. And there's one, I can't remember. And of course, Special Operations Forces Africa is also in Germany, I believe in Stuttgart. And then they have a presence on the continent in terms of defense attachés and regional security officers within the U.S. Embassy country teams. And so going back to what you mentioned about the staffing, I believe that when AFRICOM was originally stood up, it was supposed to be a interagency combatant command. That was part of the novelty of it at the time. And I believe that there were difficulties in achieving the requisite level or the desired level of interagency staffing for various reasons. Among those were difficulty getting buy-in in terms of a need for the interagency stakeholders to send people over to Stuttgart to sit at AFRICOM, possibly difficulty in paying for the billet. It could be that some of these agencies are already short-staffed, so why should they send someone over to this new military command? And I do believe, I was reading earlier in a GAO report on actually humanitarian assistance, that AFRICOM has the highest level among the COCOMs of interagency reps, but it's still not very high. I think I read, like, actually, I'm not going to quote that because I don't remember how many it was. What else do you want to funding?
Like, what you've described here is very complex, and it really seems, you know, in the paper you wrote, Capacity Building, Key to AFRICOM's Mission, which I suggest everybody read, you know, you made this great point that the funding streams, you know, they're just not coming from DOD. You know, they're also coming from different agencies. And then, you know, it's the funding stream isn't, in, you know, very large. Like, it really seemed like when I was reading through the paper, like, I was just surprised, like, $9 million for all of Nigeria, or I don't know if I got it correctly, but, you know, it seems like, you know, in terms of, you know, funding streams that I associate with DOD, AFRICOM's funding streams seem to be not the lowest, but sort of comparatively lower, you know. I mean, how does AFRICOM, you know, in comparison to other comms, you know, how is it, you know, funded, you know, are, you know, is its funding streams comparable? Or is it sort of this little command, you know, that really is put off into the corner and, you know, occasionally they'll give them $100 million and then walk away?
Well, I can't necessarily make the comparison to other COCOMs, but I do know that since AFRICOM has been stood up, there have been, I think they have been trying to get more resources than they've been allocated, but then again, you can argue that that's just what, I mean, that's in the self-interest of any leader of any bureaucracy to get as many resources as possible. I think that figuring out how parts of the U.S. government are funded, this is not, in my experience, unique to DOD, is incredibly infuriating. In fact, there was, I think Todd Moss wrote a blog post a few weeks ago, or maybe a few months ago, where he was talking about the difficulty of trying to track down funding for U.S. counterterrorism ops in West Africa, and he said even the people whose job it is to track these down don't know where the funding comes from and what what are the restrictions on it, because it's so incredibly complex. But that's a side note. But AFRICOM operates off of the majority of AFRICOM's building partner capacity funds come from Title 22, which is State Department foreign assistance or security assistance funding. And then some of it comes from Title 10 funding, which is armed services funding. And that includes the Section 1206 funds and the what used to be 1207, but now there's a new 1207, which is called the Global Security Contingency Fund, which is for crisis response operations, I believe, as opposed to conflict prevention and steady state operations. And some of the issues I raised in the paper are that a lot of these funding streams have restrictions on what sorts of activities they can fund. So, for example, you might have the Navy trying to plan a, you know, Africa partnership station. And they may be able to cover funds for the ship and the operation of the ship from one pot of money, but then they have to pay for the sailors from another pot of money, and then they have to pay for the participation of the African countries from another pot of money, but then they have to pay for the transportation from another pot of money. And that's just an example of how complex it could be. And all of that money might not be available at the same time, or there may be... Wow. And then those challenges have implications for planning. So if you're not able to prepare, if you can't anticipate what funding is going to be available year to year, how do you plan right. successfully. And that, in my experience in security cooperation planning, that's been a challenge for AFRICOM, especially having no assigned forces until recently.
So then layered on top of these financial challenges seems to be legal challenges, sort of the Leahy Amendment. It seems like, you know, for a little background, the Leahy Amendment, you know, I think you basically have to make sure that the people that are receiving money don't have human rights violations. I think that's the Leahy Amendment.
That's the gist of it.
The gist of it. But I mean, sort of, you know, not just the Leahy Amendment, but some of the other legal challenges. Sort of highlight those if you can, because it seems like, you know, the funding streams are pretty complex, and now the sort of the more legal issues, you know, add, you know, much more complexity. I mean, how does that limit or how does that enhance AFRICOM, if it does?
Well, let's start out with enhancement. It enhances AFRICOM because, at least in principle, we're not training people, we, the United States, are not training people that have a record of human rights violations. That said, you can't dictate what they're going to do in the future. And so there's an entirely real possibility that the people you train may or may not contribute to human rights violations in the future. Oops.
Awkward.
Hashtag awkward. however, it's also a complicating factor because if you think hypothetically, if the U.S. were to be funding, if the U.S. were to be supporting a multinational intervention force to go into an African country that is at crisis, if the countries that are contributing to that operation, if let's say 70 to 80% of their units fail Leahy vetting, then what are you supposed to do? That means that for just completely arbitrarily, let's say the countries that you're thinking of supporting are Mozambique and Angola. Let's say Mozambique fails its Leahy vetting, or 80% of their forces fail, whereas only 20% of Angola's forces fail. That means that you can't work with And let's just say, again, to throw an element of complexity into it, what if the Mozambicans are contributing way more forces than the Angolans? That means you can't really work with the majority of forces there. It's still a good idea that you have that sort of vetting, but it creates complications in funding.
I mean, is there a waiver process? I mean, it seems like in the example you used, it wouldn't even be feasible to, you know, sort of produce the organization because 80% of the people you want to use fail under the amendment. So, I mean, is there a waiver process and sort of does the command sort of push for, you know, for certain things to be waived under the law? Or is it just sort of a resignation, you know, and then you have to hit the reset button and sort of, you know, try to deal, you know, to sort of work with what you have? Or is it, you know...
That I don't know in particular. Also, I don't necessarily know that it is the COCOM that would be dealing with Leahy. Another thing I should have mentioned earlier is that a majority of the security assistance funding comes from the State Department. And so they're the ones that have oversight over it, although it is often turned over to DOD for implementation. And so they may be the ones dealing with the Leahy vetting process. But I don't know if there's a waiver process. I certainly hope not, because I do think it is, in principle, an excellent rule to have, even though it can be difficult to get around.
Okay, so let's switch gears just a little. You know, so sort of DOD and the government as a whole, not just DOD, they're facing huge budget cuts, you know. And I'm curious, you know, how will these budget cuts sort of affect AFRICOM? If, you know, either AFRICOM directly or, you know, the State Department's funding, you know, et cetera. And then, you know, does this affect the mission? I mean, it seems like, you know, through your article and some of the points you've made today, that AFRICOM's mission is really this light footprint, that really, even if you were to cut money from, you know, AFRICOM, really, it's been doing a lot more with a lot less already. You know, so do you think the, you know, these budget cuts that are coming up or, you know, or these budget cuts that are being, you know, implemented, do you think it's going to affect their mission or not? I mean, sort of.
I think that it's entirely possible that AFRICOM may be among the best suited to weather the coming climate, just because the coming fiscal climate, just because they've been accustomed, since they were stood up, they've been accustomed to working with less, having to do more with less, increasingly these days. And I think that if you look at the Defense Strategic Guidance that was released last year that talked about the small footprint, lighter approach to engagement, and if you look at General Hamm's statements, the public statements he's made in recent months, he talks about how AFRICOM is really institutionalizing that sort of approach and integrating it into its theater security cooperation. I should note that AFRICOM is, for the first time, going to get assigned forces. The Army is assigning a regionally aligned force to AFRICOM in fiscal year 13. And now they're supposed to be training and getting ready to I think they're supposed to do 96 engagements in 35 countries on a rotational basis. So I believe they're based in Fort Riley, Kansas, and they're going to the continent, to and from the continent, in small teams. And that, I see that as a way of institutionalizing this sort of small footprint, light engagement approach.
So in terms of, like, the budgetary arguments that, you know, they make, you know, do you think, I mean, you made this great point before we started recording, was that, you know, prevention of conflict and sort of capacity building really doesn't get funded as much as, let's say, you know, dealing with conflict and your hair being on fire, you know, because, you know, for multiple reasons, you know, the media sort of focuses on Mali and sort of Libya and, you know, the big joke is, you know, if you can raise the specter of the, you know, war on terror, you're going to get money. But I mean, that's the jokes, you know, but like in terms of making a budgetary argument and sort of saying, you know, you should fund AFRICOM and sort of associated, you know, the associated funding stream should always have money in them. Sort of, how does AFRICOM make that, you know, how does AFRICOM make that argument successfully when, you know, it's prevention of conflict, you know, its mission seems to be just as much prevention of conflict as putting out fires.
You're right, and I'm glad you raised that point. My article focuses mostly on the partner capacity building mission, but there is a very, very sexy counterterrorism mission that AFRICOM does as well that gets a lot of media play. And I think the point I was trying to make in my article is that before we were doing these... before we were doing what we're doing right now in the Sahel, we were doing building partner capacity. We're still doing it. We're going to do it in the future. And I think that's important to raise that point, that there is a level of steady state theater security cooperation that goes on the continent while everyone's hair is on fire about the latest crisis. The problem with that is that if you look, on one hand, building partner capacity is very much focused on conflict prevention. And if you try and figure out how do you measure success of conflict prevention, how do you measure something that hasn't happened? You know, right. So it's a lot less tangible than saying how, you know, on the other hand, you have counterterrorism operations, which have, like, for example, if you have a drone strike or you have a terrorist killed, you're able to show tangible success. Right. So why not give more money to that effort? And so I think that's a challenge, especially moving ahead in terms of budget cuts across the Defense Department. I could see how these building partner capacity missions could fall by the wayside more and more just out of necessity because there's less of a tangible benefit.
But, I mean, do you see it as a risk then? Sort of, you know, the capacity mission falls by the wayside because it's simply not funded, whereas all the money... is going to CT, so suddenly, you know, the push in AFRICOM becomes more, it becomes more of a CT organization and sort of moves away from that original capacity building purpose. Or is that, you know, that's more of an exaggeration?
I think there is a risk, certainly. I think that, moving towards a counterterrorism, a more counterterrorism focused COCOM addresses the symptoms of the problem, or the causes of the problem, without addressing the symptoms, which is a non-DOD interagency approach that would also bring in AFRICOM's focus on theater security cooperation or building partner capacity. And also, if you look at building partner capacity, it is something that has a, well, let me just give you an example. Senegal has one of the most professional militaries in Africa. Okay.
Okay.
And we have, the United States has an excellent relationship with Senegal, from what I can tell. And their military has never had a coup. You can usually call on them to contribute to peacekeeping operations. I think they're actually one of the top five African contributors of peacekeeping operations. So they're a country that you really want to make sure that they don't have conflict in their own country, because if they have conflict in their own country, then they're less willing to contribute to your regional peacekeeping operation. On the other hand, you're also working, trying to work with their military because they're stable, because you're trying to keep their military professional and capable, because it does contribute to, at least from the outside, it does contribute to stability in the country and in the region. If you stop doing, or if you lessen the building partner capacity mission, then the possible implication is you're not supporting as many militaries like that, that are good examples. And also, you're not trying to reform militaries that have fallen by the wayside, but are trying to get back on the right track. And an example of that may be Guinea. I don't know much about Guinea, but I've heard good things about our security sector reform process there.
So do you think then, sort of as you push towards CT then, sort of these more, you know, institution building, capacity building, you know, do you think it'll sort of, you know, the emphasis will become action then, sort of, you know, the competence of the military, of, you know, the capacity building, you know, the target of the capacity building sort of falls to the wayside, and they say, you know, what we really want isn't necessarily a competent military or, you know, an institution that can support a professional, competent military, but rather we just want results. I mean, do you think, I mean, it really seems like, in terms of metrics, you made this point, a good point, I think, is that, you know, CT gives you results then and there, and that's the purpose of, you know, CT has big, sexy results, whereas prevention of conflict and capacity building doesn't. And so sort of, you know, the funding stream sort of dries up, or, I don't know. It you know, I mean, does it switch then? I mean, with CT, you know, focusing more on training a military that can go out and kill as opposed to one that is professional and sort of subordinate to civil government. You know what I mean? It's sort of pushing towards a more aggressive posture as opposed to being concerned with the institution and sort of the context. Or am I off in this case, or in this idea?
What was your question?
Sorry.
Sorry. I'm trying to figure out which
one of my flaws. Anyway, let's move on then to, you know, what would you consider to be AFRICOM's successes then? As a, you know, what are some of the, you know, accomplishments of AFRICOM that you can sort of hold up as a success, you know, in its own sort of, within its own mission and within, you know, its own sort of prerogative? I mean,
I'm glad we keep coming back to the metrics of success question, just because as an analyst of African security and as someone who works on security cooperation in the AFRICOM AOR, it's always challenging to try and figure out how you define success when you're trying to prevent conflict or when you're trying to build a professional military. Do you define success by the fact that we've been working with the Nigerians since they returned to democracy 14 years ago and they have not launched a coup yet? Even though there was an instance, I think back in 2009 or 2010, when there was an executive leadership vacuum and people here in DC were fretting about the military stepping in and taking control, and they didn't. Can you mark that as a success? I don't know. There might have been other factors at play. Can you? Another example is with the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM. When AFRICOM was stood up, there was a definite demand signal for training of the Ugandan forces, which at that time were the only troop-contributing nations in Somalia who volunteered for the AMISOM mission. They did a really, really terrible job for the first few years. And then I don't know whether it was that the situation on the ground in Somalia was changing or that more countries started to contribute. You got the Burundians involved, and then you had the Kenyans invading, and then you also had al-Shabaab facing a multiple front offensive. Well, 5 years after, it was five, I think, years after the Amisom mission stood up, you finally had Mogadishu. Amisom was finally able to move out of Mogadishu. You had the Kenyans carving out a sphere of control in the south. You had the Ethiopians controlling the border. And you finally were able to have success. Can you directly attribute that to our U.S. training of the Ugandans and the other troop contributing nations? Possibly, but there were also other factors at play. But those are, I guess, two of the successes. But at the same time, I know you're going to ask me about failures, so I'm just going to jump right to that. At the same time, you would think that, okay, so the command is only, it's going to be 5 years old as a unified command. It's going to be five in October. And you could argue that it's still working out the kinks. It's still trying to figure out how things work and what its exact mission is and how does it engage with regional countries and with the regional organizations. At the same time, if you look at what's going on in Mali, one would think that, well, I think that the difficulties that we've had trying to get troop contributing, trying to get countries to contribute troops, and the fact that they're having trouble with getting their soldiers there, basing their soldiers, making sure their soldiers have uniforms, and making sure their soldiers are fed. And that's only, they're only in Bamako, like they haven't even gone to the north. So those sorts of challenges that they're facing, those are things that we should have been working with them on for the past 5 years. Although we probably have, but I mean, this shows an example of why there's a demand signal for AFRICOM to respond to this sort of crisis and what needs to be done to improve what they're doing.
So do you think in sort of its failures then, sort of, it seems to be that, you know, ISR, you know, the idea of, you know, being able to produce, not only just provide intel, surveillance, and reconnaissance, but also general logistics. I mean, would that be fair to say that AFRICOM, that seems to be not a failure, but sort of a kink that it needs to work out, being able to sort of provide some of the more back, you know, back room sort of, not services, but, you know, capacity to these forces? Or is that too broad?
I think, I don't necessarily know that it's a failure on AFRICOM's part, because at least in my experience working on this, many countries in Africa don't have a maintenance culture. They don't have a good procurement culture. So they don't have the right equipment that they need to be able to carry out the missions that they're expected to carry out. And on top of that, a lot of countries don't maintain the equipment that they have. And so when it comes to deploying in support of a peacekeeping operation, this is where you actually see evidence of these problems. I'm sure that AFRICOM has worked with these countries on these sorts of issues, but a key issue that needs to be highlighted is if you don't have partner nation political will, and I guess just general willingness to develop those sorts of capabilities, then there's not much that we as the United States can do.
I mean, do you think it's then, you know, the issue with procurement and maintenance? I mean, the issue seems to be, you know, you sort of hinted at it, that even if the U.S. is able to acquire, let's say, a new weapon system, and then, you know, it's given to this force, then really the issue is maintenance and sort of, you know, it's, you know, so the issue seems to be procurement and maintenance and sort of even acquisition then. Or am I off in this? I mean, it seems like, I mean, it really does, like, procurement and maintenance really, it seems to be coming up more and more in these sort of light footprint missions. Because I remember sort of, you know, reading, you know, I know you can't sort of necessarily comment on, you know, what's happening in Afghanistan, but it seems to be coming up in Afghanistan where, you know, you buy everything for, you know, the capacity for everybody that you're trying to train, but then you realize that, you know, the issue isn't really buying and giving, but rather, you know, the capacity to maintain and to sort of, you know, to keep it up and to sort of, you know, keep it up through operational cycles. I mean,
This is a massive problem in Africa, huge, especially because, as you said, sometimes there's not the capabilities on site to maintain whatever equipment that we've given them, which is why I usually... Oh, I just remembered another point, which absolutely infuriates me. Some of these countries don't even have money in their budgets to maintain whatever we give them. And so I'm like, well, why are you giving them a ship? Like, what is the point of this? You should focus on building professional capabilities, making sure you have a professional sailor, and then maybe one day when they start budgeting for whatever maritime security mission they have, maybe then you can give them a ship. Yeah, so what you've described is not only a problem in Afghanistan, but also across Africa.
So then, sort of a critique of AFRICOM that sort of has come up is, you know, it's I think, in my view, it's an extreme critique, but it, you know, it seems to make the point that really AFRICOM is all about, you know, north of the equator and where there are CT hotspots, you know, or where there is... I think, you know, north of the equator and then where there's, you know, more recently where there's CT hotspots. So Somalia, Kenya, Mali, and, you know, even counter-narcotics in Senegal and sort of, you know, the Ivory Coast. So would you consider that a failure, or do you think it's more of a kink? That, you know, this idea that they're really just limiting their area of operations to north of the equator and to this particular band of, you know, missions... I mean, would you consider that a failure, or would you consider that something that is, you know, they're sort of working through and working out?
I think that the focus, as you say, north of the equator, mostly on East, West, and North Africa, is because there's a demand signal for engagement, or not engagement, that's the wrong term. There's a demand signal for action. However, I do believe AFRICOM is doing these capacity building missions across the continent, and that would include in Southern Africa. It's just that the most, you hear about more activity. It's more reported on because it's counterterrorism focused and because it's surrounding the crises of the day. So in Somalia and in Mali.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, so my last question is always, it's more theoretical than, you know.
I have another failure.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead.
I forgot to mention it earlier.
Too aggressive.
I don't want this to go by without me mentioning Mali as a failure. Although my personal belief is that Mali is not a DOD failure. It is not an AFRICOM failure alone. I think it's a U.S. government-wide failure. I think that, I mean, for example, if you look at Bruce Whitehouse had this amazing paper, which I referenced in my article in the London Review of Books, where he talked about how... everyone who engaged with Mali, the U.S. included, perceived, it turned a blind eye to what was going on in Mali in terms of, like, weak institutions, the increasing centralization of power in ATT, and how we so, or at least my perspective is, we so desperately needed Mali to be functional because it was in this crappy neighborhood that was coup-prone, and so Mali being stable was good enough. And DOD also fell into that category of, well, we train with the Mali Armed Forces because they're part of the regional counterterrorism approach, and they are not like the Mauritanians and launching coups all the time. They're not like the Nigerians and launching coups all the time, so we can work with these guys. However, the failure in my perspective is that, and you can see this echoed in General Hamm's comments, specifically, he spoke at Howard, and the transcript is online somewhere. I wasn't there. But he alludes to the fact that AFRICOM should have been more focused on, I think it was values and ethos and building those sorts of characteristics within the soldiers it was training, so that, these are my words, I should specify that, so that they're not building coup-making forces across Africa. I think Mali was a huge shock for everyone working on Mali, specifically with DOD, just because they had such a beautiful return to democracy 21 years before the coup, and it was seen as a success story. And I think that it's now, especially with the new commander coming in, and especially in an era of budget cuts where you have to really think about what you want to prioritize and what your outcomes, what your desired outcomes are, now is an excellent time to think about more institutionally focused capacity building. Even though it's not the sexiest topic, it's probably not going to get above the line in terms of funding, but Mali is a screaming example of why you can't just build security forces and just build them willy-nilly. You have to focus on professionalization, you have to focus on other elements of the government. So ensuring that institutions are strengthened across the government, ensuring that there's no unequal development assistance across the country. Mind you, this is all contingent on partner nation willingness, but now is a time to re-examine all of this without exclusively casting the blame on AFRICOM.
That makes sense. Okay, so last question is always sort of theoretical, sort of fun. I mean, the conversation has been fun, but super fun.
Thanks. No.
Okay, so the last question is, if you were put in charge of AFRICOM tomorrow, if, you know, somebody from the Obama administration came down to the office and basically said, you know, you're in charge of AFRICOM, you know, you're going to make all the funding decisions and, you know, all the command decisions, it's all you, right? So what would you change? And then, you know, sort of a second part of that is, what would you keep the same? You know, it could be anything. You could, you know, change whatever you want. But, I mean, you still, like, I'll put a limit on this question, and the only limit is that you sort of have to stay, you know, within, you know, budgetary constraints and sort of the basic mission of capacity building and the light footprint.
So yeah. I can't move to Lamu, Kenya? It's really nice. Can't move the whole command there?
No, I mean...
I'm kidding.
No, I mean, that's a good point, because it's, you know, from my understanding, it's, the headquarters is, you know...
Stuttgart.
So that's Germany.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let's start there. I mean, why is it in Germany? I mean, it seems like, you know, at least CENTCOM is, you know, based in the Middle East. You know, Eurocom is, I'm assuming it's based in Europe. But, I mean, why is AFRICOM based in Germany? I can't even fathom the distance. I mean, you have to cross Italy, the Mediterranean, and then you just get into North Africa. I mean, why isn't the headquarters...
In Africa. Well, most of the COCOMs and the components are, well, I think I'll just speak to the COCOMs. Most of the COCOMs are based outside of their area of responsibility. So CENTCOM is based in Florida, and UCOM is actually based in Europe. It's, good God, I don't remember where it is. Actually, it might be near Stuttgart. And I think that AFRICOM spaces are taken over from UCOM. And then PACOM is in Hawaii. And then if you look at the components, Naval Forces Central Command is based in Bahrain, but most other COCOMs and components are based outside of their area of responsibility. And this was a huge question, issue for debate when AFRICOM was first rolled out. But if you think about stability in Africa, and even how the most stable countries, let's use Kenya as an example, because the elections are coming up next week, even the most seemingly stable countries can erupt into violence. And what would be the implications of having a massive military facility there, U.S. military facility, and then being able to ensure security for your personnel, their spouses, their children, finding good schools for them to go to, and then if you need to, medevacing them out to Europe or to the United States. So that's why having a headquarters in Germany makes more sense than it does in Africa. I would argue that it should move to Norfolk just because it could occupy the spaces taken over by GIFCOM and provide jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And also it'd be easier for me to go to because I don't like Stuttgart. Anyway, good beer though. But getting back to your issue of what would you change? I jokingly said I would move it to Lamu, Kenya, just because it's delightful and it's like, it's just the most wonderful place on earth, and just to work out of there would be great. But more seriously, I think I would go back to what you asked a few questions ago about addressing failures, and I would really encourage a greater focus on less kinetic, more institution building, professionalization of the military, even if it is at the expense of more kinetic operations, just because I think that General Ward had a quote about AFRICOM trying to do no harm. I think that if you don't focus on institutions and on professionalization more, obviously they were before, but Molly shows us that you can never do enough. I think that if you don't focus more on that, you are actually doing harm. And, you know, as someone who works on African security, I don't want to seem like someone who's drank the Kool-Aid and who's, like, you know, hooray AFRICOM, I do think that this is a major failure, and they need to address this in order to move forward successfully. Another issue I would change, it seems kind of arbitrary, but it was raised by you on Twitter, actually. I would have the combatant commander stay there longer than 2 years. So Ward was there for, I think, three. He was there from, as a unified command, he was there for October 2008 to March 2011. Ham was only there for 2 years. Rodriguez might only be there for 2 years. Who really knows? But in one of Ham's recent statements, he said he had no experience in Africa before this. Most military officers don't have a lot of experience in Africa. And I think that dealing with a combatant command that is 53 countries, and then each country is a microcosm of its own self, you know, and having to deal with a bureaucracy, you know, AFRICOM as a bureaucracy, as a new combatant commander, in addition to the fact that AFRICOM itself is learning and adapting and growing, and you yourself as the commander are learning, adapting, and growing, and then on top of that having to deal with 53 countries that are extremely diverse and complex, I think that it would be useful if they were there for at least 3 years, if not longer, just to get the hang of things, because I feel like after 2 years, you've just started to get the hang of how things work, and now you're moving on, and you're not, there's no way to capitalize on that long experience.
So I really don't have a lot of experience in military organizations. So when Ward moves and when Ham moves, he's like, it's just, you're just changing a general, or are you changing staff too?
I believe it's just changing the general. Okay. Yeah.
So, I mean, would you say that AFRICOM, sort of to build on your, would you say that its strength is really not necessarily in its generalship, but it's sort of the staff and the associated sort of, you know, the associated, you know, bureaucracy? Or is that, you know, I mean, you know, it seems like all, you know, to your point, you're institutionalizing it and you're building knowledge. So you could still retain that knowledge and, you know, expertise, whereas, you know, you could easily just switch out a general. Or is that off base?
Some of the staff still rotates out every 2 to 3 years. And okay. So that's also a problem in terms of institutionalizing, but that's just the way the military works. And so there's no helping that. But I think having someone at the helm who stays there a bit longer and has that level of knowledge of what's going on the continent would be beneficial.
So what would you keep the same? I mean, it seems like you threw out, you know, you change a lot, but I mean, you know, what is AFRICOM doing well? And, you know, by extension, what would you just keep the same and sort of, you know, have it stay the course? Or is that, you know, what would you keep the same?
What would I keep the same? I think you could tell from what I've written and from this interview, I'm a huge fan of this steady state theater security cooperation, because I believe that in the long term, it is what helps build relationships with government and military officials in African countries, and that it has an impact, it increases our influence in those countries in terms of those personal relationships that are built based on our engagement with those countries. And I also believe that when it comes to stability, those relationships might be beneficial to ensuring that those militaries are professional and that they conduct themselves in a manner that is befitting our, you know, the fact that we've trained them.
That's good. So, anything else you would like to add before I stop the record button? I mean, it seems like we've covered a lot. So, I mean, is there anything you want to add? Any ending comments? Anything?
Thanks again for having me on the Loopcast. This is cool. I look forward to hearing how it comes out. And I also, on March 7th, the Senate Armed Services Committee is having AFRICOM testify. That happens usually every March. And I don't know who's doing the testimony. It might be General Ham, since I think he's still there. And that should give us a sense. If it is General Rodriguez, that would give us a sense maybe for, you know, how the command is moving ahead. But I expect that since this is the first testimony since the coup in Mali, there may be some language in that posture statement that might dictate where, or that might indicate where the command might be heading in the future. So that's just something to watch out for.
Nice. So March 7th, we'll be on the lookout for that. And then don't forget to check out Leslie's article, Capacity Building, Key to AFRICOM's Mission. I think, you know, as somebody who doesn't focus on Africa, it was really informative and sort of, you know, incredibly well written, and, you know, it's worth, you know, everybody's time. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.